From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll discuss the importance of civility and how it can be achieved through building better relationships. Then we learn about the importance of court interpreters.
If a person is not able to understand what's happening to their lives, an interpreter is allowing that person to really pursue justice.
We'll hear from the director of the documentary Growing Up Milwaukee about how she tells stories behind the city's negative statistics.
So I set out to be able to tell the stories behind those statistics, but I also wanted to do it from the youth perspective because I know that the youth are our future.
Plus, hear music from Racine blues musician Stephen Hull. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll hear from the director of the film Growing Up Milwaukee, learn about a court interpreter training program, and hear music from Racine native Stephen Hull. We'll start with this. The decade civility died. That's what some have dubbed the 2010s. And it may come as no surprise that many Americans feel like civility is no longer attainable. But UW-Milwaukee professor Bill Keith disagrees. Not only does he believe it's possible, but he says it's necessary to a functioning democracy. Keith is the co-author of a new book called Beyond Civility: The Competing Obligations of Citizenship. He joined me recently to talk about it. Bill, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
What do you think civility in general means right now in this moment that we're living in?
I think civility, I can't decide. I've been talking to people about that. Is that there's a project I've been working on for now about 7 years. And did I choose the perfect time for a book to come out or the worst possible time for a book to come out? So a lot of people are very concerned about civility now. They're concerned about a loss of it. They're concerned about recovering it. But why is it so important to people? That's a really good question. And I think it's important to people because we have a political system in which the way we understand that political system is that it works basically through people talking to each other. And talking to each other on a number of different levels, right? So you have the debates that happen within the U.S. Senate that's talking. You have the entire media ecosystem in which arguments and ideas and images flow back and forth. You also have the talking that you do with people you know, some of whom you may know a little bit. You may have a conversation with your postal carrier, some people you know very well, with family members about public topics. So the United States, as a kind of democracy, does seem to make decisions based on the outcomes of large conversations. And so if we look at over the last 20 years, the way in which things have changed relative to marriage equality. 20 years ago, it was hard to talk about the legalization of gay marriage. It was difficult. People got angry. It seemed impossible. It seemed like there were legal barriers. And after about 10 years of conversation on many different levels, then it sort of became somehow obvious that this probably was okay and had to happen. Are there still a minority of people who disagree? Of course. There's always a minority of people who disagree. But that doesn't prevent us from actually moving forward. So that's a case where the conversations, the arguments, the flow of discourse, mostly civil, sometimes a little bit less, did seem to make a positive change. But now we're in a period of time after 4 years where we feel like this is spiraling out of control, that somehow talk is actually working against us and it's not productive.
I think that gets to this idea of civility, the necessity of it, but also the limitations of it. We're living in a moment where people can't agree on basic facts. People can't agree that, you know, the grass is green, as it were. How do you use civility in a situation where just the core principles of people seem to be so divergent?
So I want to reframe that a little bit and make it a more general point about the way that we look at public discourse and government as well. So a lot of times people say, oh, government is terrible. Politicians are terrible. surveys have shown for decades that people say politicians are terrible and dishonest and greedy, except for mine. The person I elected, they're great. It's just everybody else, right? So there is a bias built into the way that we talk about this. When people say they don't like government, they're usually talking about the latest drama at the national level. They're not talking about their local government, which may actually work pretty well. So when you say we can't agree on basic facts, actually, we mostly do agree on basic facts. So there is this moment we have in all the agreements that we have about how things work and how stoplights work and all this stuff, where certain things become politicized. I think we can agree on the color of the grass. That will work. We can't seem to agree on masks, even though a lot of people think that's pretty much as factual as the grass. So then the question is, okay, you have these pain points, these problems where things are heavily polarized, heavily politicized. And that is where it's difficult. And so you're calling in civility to solve the problem, which in some ways has moved past that. But of course, the point of civility is to try to maintain enough of a relationship with people so that you can actually disagree with them. And this is one of the things that we talk about in the book, is the difference between weak civility and strong civility. Weak civility is behaviors and norms that sort of maintain the appearance of ease and comfort and belonging. And this is equivalent to just strategically ignoring things that are difficult. So when people say, okay, at the Thanksgiving dinner table or whatever, we're not going to talk about politics or religion, that's weak civility. So people, in a sense, are being civil. They talk about the weather and sports and other things, but they don't get to places that are hard. A democracy requires strong civility, which is a set of behaviors and norms that allow people to disagree and disagree deeply. And so what's lost right now is the feeling that we're able to do productive disagreement. So a lot of the things end up people shouting, you know, their own truths at each other without actually engaging each other. And of course, social media is a huge complication to the entire process.
Social media is especially the place that I think a lot of people encounter this. You know, getting back to this idea of just core facts, we just witnessed an insurrection at our nation's capital that was inspired by groups that believe, and this is going to sound bizarre, but believe that many politicians and major media figures eat babies. Although it might seem fringe, I think a lot of people are dealing with people who believe these things in their normal life. We just saw many of them attack politicians or try to. Is civility what we use in that moment, or is civility divorced from that?
So in general, I think when the violence begins, you've crossed the line and civility is no longer the thing which is in play. The point of civility is to allow people to disagree without it turning into violence. And so once it turns into violence, you've left that place, right? Because in America, for the most part, we don't use violence for political ends. We don't solve political problems through assassinations and bombings. Now, conspiracy groups, conspiracy theories are not new to the U.S. They were part of the founding. In the middle of the 19th century, there was the Know-Nothing Party, which was basically a white supremacist conspiracy party in which they didn't want people to actually realize what they were about. So if they were asked about it, they would say, I know nothing. And that's how they earned that name. In the 1930s, we had on the radio a new technology at that time, Father Coughlin, who spread anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, in particular cast at President Roosevelt. So these things we've had all along. So the question is, like, what's different now? People have always been able to get together and talk about their ideas, some of which, as you say, are fringe, some which seem ludicrous, but obviously they take them quite seriously. Civility is a kind of relationship with people. So if you have this relationship, then you're able to do disagreement with each other. You're able to critique each other's ideas and arguments without breaking the relationship. Social media does not foster those kinds of relationships. Social media relationships are incredibly shallow, right? So people read posts, they click like or dislike, they share things on Twitter, they don't share things on Twitter. Twitter and Facebook are set up to make money. Every time someone clicks, somebody gets paid. The things that make people click tend to be the things that make people angry. Extreme emotion is what drives those. Now, when you think about civil relationships, especially in the sense of strong civility, they're not typically driven by drama. You probably know people in your life that you've had long-running arguments with about what is the correct shape of government, or about a specific policy. What should we do about immigration or prison reform or whatever? And you've had this disagreement and you've gone back and forth over maybe many years. That's a strong relationship. That's a relationship of strong civility. In strong civility, you should also be able to call people out. Civility is coming together as civil society, making people uncomfortable and doing the right thing and yelling at people who are not doing the right thing when you have to. The possibility for loud disagreement is built into civility, but it really can't cross the line. And part of the problem now, too, is that the way in which we have understood our public relationships, we used to think, you know, we're all in this together. We're two different parties, but we're all Americans. We share U.S. history, et cetera. But now people are starting to get into relationships with each other where they say, well, no, we have the real truth and those people aren't Americans. They're not just wrong, they're evil. People, you know, they have their own kind of media consumption and they've gotten interested and they've read a bunch of things that have led them to think this certain thing is very plausible and you find it ridiculous. So, okay, how do you engage that, right? You in good faith find it ridiculous. They in good faith find it plausible. So what do you do about that? How do you talk to a flat earther or an anti-vaxxer? Or I want to say that if you think of it in a sort of a close confine there, I'm just talking to this person who I otherwise don't know about this one difficult hot button issue. You're really not going to get anywhere. Civility is not your friend. Civility is a network of behaviors and norms in a relationship over time. So you really have to ask yourself, what is my relationship with this person? And have I laid the groundwork to be able to have this kind of disagreement with them? Is there the trust there that we could actually listen to each other? Because, of course, you find what they're talking about ridiculous, but you should be, on the grounds of strong civility, listening to what they have to say as well, right? And not starting from the position that, well, I'm right and they're wrong, and so how do I get them to believe what I do? That isn't actually very civil. So it's probably true that what you need to do is begin building relationships with people on things that you do actually agree about. And there's a lot of stuff you do agree about. Because, of course, it's much easier to have policy arguments when you already agree about 95% of things. It's harder to do it when it's only 70% or 50%. But for most people, there are a lot of things that they do agree about. There's values that they share in common, and those become points for moving forward. Does that pre-exist the conversation you're having? Probably not. So you have to do the work to develop it. Whatever that background of agreement is that'll allow you to move forward, you have to work on that and you have to keep working on that, right? It doesn't automatically come. And so it's sort of deceptive. You can watch certain kinds of talk shows on TV where everybody's basically in the same place and they have these conversations. They're really interesting and really interesting arguments and the way they use evidence. But that's a kind of artificial situation. The ones in our daily lives typically aren't like that.
What is the end goal of civility?
It is keeping the dialogue going. It's keeping the discussion alive. Part of the way that we think about democracy is that so the people decide. People don't decide blindly. They sort of decide on the basis of these ongoing long-term conversations about things. So if you go back 100 years, first you have the creation of the income tax, then you have the reforms of the New Deal. These were the result of people talking about things are broken and they need to change. There was a lot of discourse during the 1930s about how did we end up here? What is so broken? What do we need to change? And that provided the basis for accepting many of the reforms that Roosevelt had. So the thing is not that we should all end up agreeing. Because at a certain point, but also not that we should understand ourselves as winners and losers, that we evolve better and better policies. Basically, the way liberal democracy seems to work is that we see a set of problems, we try solutions. Solutions have their own weaknesses and problems. We try to address those, and so on, right? There is no point at which we get a perfect government, a perfect set of policies, or that we all agree. We should have disagreement. We should have people poking holes and making objections because that improves our chances at doing this kind of problem solving. But right now, it's very hard to do because in the public sphere, people seem very dug in and they seem, especially if you're on social media, more interested in yelling at each other and calling each other names than in doing anything that's helpful.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
My pleasure.
Bill Keith is a professor in the English department at UW-Milwaukee and the co-author of Beyond Civility, The Competing Obligations of Citizenship. Going to court, whether it's a criminal defendant or just to fight a parking ticket, is a stressful experience. But imagine if you had to do it and you couldn't understand what the judge or your attorneys were saying. That's often the case for people who aren't proficient in English or are hearing impaired in Wisconsin courtrooms. Deborah Gora Barash is a court-certified American Sign Language interpreter who noticed a need for more interpreters and better training. Now she instructs a program at UW-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education to help fix this problem. Barash spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver in February about the Legal Interpreter Training Program.
One of the motivators for me to personally develop this training program was because for many years I just see this, what I call a hidden injustice. And that is for people who are in our legal system, if English is not their first language and an interpreter is required for communication. And notice I didn't say that the interpreter is for the person who doesn't speak English, because the interpreter is for everyone in an environment. Because a judge or an attorney can understand the person who doesn't speak English just as much as the person who doesn't speak English understand those who do. And if a person is not able to understand what's happening to their lives, an interpreter is allowing that person and everyone else in the environment to really pursue justice. If they're not able to understand, a person's constitutional rights could be violated, which is what motivated me to create this program, because we have so many interpreters who have not been trained and are not qualified but are interpreting, and it's not their fault. And it's not the fault of the judicial system, although the judicial system continues to hire interpreters who are not qualified because they basically don't have a choice. The National Center for State Courts offers legal certification in 18 different languages, which sounds like a lot. But even here in Wisconsin, we use in our Wisconsin court system somewhere between 55 and 60 different languages every year in our court system. So that leaves a significant number of languages that have no certification. And that includes sign language interpreters now, because we used to have a legal certification and that is no more. And so for all the languages that do not have a certification, a person can be hired, walk into court and start interpreting, and no one has any idea whether that person actually can interpret at the level that's needed to preserve a person's constitutional right and be able to accurately interpret at the level we need for justice to be served.
How does this program, in a nutshell, then try to train people to be certified legal court interpreters?
Well, for many years, and I believe over the past, I would say 5 years or more, I have increasingly had experiences where I'm brought into a court case as a sign language interpreter, and there is also a spoken language interpreter interpreting in the same case. No one across the country has a program to teach how sign language and spoken language interpreters can work together effectively. And as I continued to have these experiences, I said, somebody has to do something about this. And so this program, in its uniqueness, is that we're training sign language and spoken language interpreters together. They are learning the similarities and differences and how to then walk into a case and say, what do we need to make sure that we're working together and this is an effective, accurate service that we're providing for all of the people in this situation. So that's a big difference in this training program than any other training program that we did a lot of research trying to find out, is there anywhere that people train sign language and spoken language interpreters together? And there isn't, as far as we've been able to find. So that's an incredible uniqueness about this program. And also the focused content about the program. we teach about culture and how that influences the interpretation, because we know in every community, in every country, there are deaf individuals. So how do we combine all of the cultural aspects in addition to the deafness or hard of hearing aspects when we're dealing with a case in court? We have legal vocabulary throughout the entire program, which is a 12-month program with 7 courses that are developed. We also are going to be doing mock hearings and at the end culminating into a mock trial. So we'll be looking at every aspect of the legal realm. We're ensuring that all the interpreters are well trained just individually to know about the legal system. And in addition to that, how do you work with sign language interpreters as well? How do they work with each other? Yes, spoken language and sign language interpreters working together.
And how do you know if someone who signs up for the course is actually proficient or fluent in the language that they're professing to be?
We do have prerequisites to be able to get into the program. And so we do look at their language and ask them to provide some verification about their language abilities and their interpreting knowledge before they even get into the course. Our Wisconsin court system, the court interpreter program, does offer a 2-day orientation program. And we require that individuals for this program at UWM have already taken that program, which gives them a very basic idea. One of the things we've heard out of that 2-day orientation program that has been in existence over the past 18 years is that most often the comment on the evaluation is, we need more training. And it just isn't out there. And so, again, that was another motivator for me, since I've been involved in that over all these years, was to say, we have to do something. We have to be able to provide some kind of credential to say to our Wisconsin court system, this person has a minimum standard of knowledge because they've been through the Wisconsin UWM training program for legal interpreters. Right now, we have nothing.
Has anyone graduated from this program yet, or is this the first?
This is the very first cohort. We started August 28th, and so we are into our third course right now, and it'll go. People will complete the program in August.
What sort of adaptations have you been able to make with COVID, and who's in the program right now?
I did not want to have to do this online, but we did because I wanted to make sure that we really were able to get this program up and established even in the midst of COVID. So I converted it completely to online. So I'm teaching it all online. Everyone's online. And as we all are saying through this pandemic, there are positives and negatives to everything. One of the very positive things is we have someone in Arizona, and we have someone who is in Costa Rica. Her home is the Green Bay, but she's in Costa Rica caring for some elderly parents, and because of that, she's able to be in the program. So that's really wonderful. We're very happy about that. We began the program with 19 participants. We were going to accept up to 20. A few of them had to drop out. We are now at 14 participants. We have American Sign Language interpreters, Spanish interpreters, Arabic, French, Hindi, Portuguese, and Hmong.
And what does life post-certificate look for these people once they've graduated from the program? Are they looking to work in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court system or around the state? And what is being a court interpreter part-time look like, or full-time?
Many sign language interpreters are able to work full-time as interpreters, and the more popular languages are able to work more full-time. But that's one of the challenges of this program. because most of the people in this program come from minority communities to begin with. Their first language is not English, so they come from those communities, and it's not lucrative where they're going to be able to work necessarily full-time as a court interpreter. Hopefully, they can develop their skills and work in other aspects, such as the medical field or even in a work environment and so forth. So having the interpreting skills under your belt and credentials is certainly helpful.
Deborah Gora-Barrage, thank you very much for your time and good luck with the program.
Thank you. Yeah, we look forward to it. Watch for more.
Deborah Gora-Barrage is an instructor for the Legal Interpreter Training Program at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver in February. Coming up, a 21-year-old man from Racine took one of the top spots in a national competition last month. In about 15 minutes, you'll hear from the self-taught musician and some of his blues music. But first, we'll hear from the director of the documentary Growing Up Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee is known as one of the worst places to live as a Black person. The city has one of the largest achievement gaps between white and Black students, staggering rates of incarceration and poverty, and it's often cited as the most segregated area in the nation. Milwaukee native Tyshawn Wardlaw wanted to highlight the stories behind these statistics. Her documentary, Growing Up Milwaukee, follows three Black teens struggling as they come of age in the city. The film also features community leaders and local organizations working to improve the lives of young Black Milwaukeeans and break the cycles so many find themselves in. Wardlaw joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in February to share more. Wardlaw begins by explaining how the project came to be.
The premise of the doc was actually created 4 years ago when I decided that, you know what, unfortunately, a lot of staggering statistics are coming out of Milwaukee in the Black community, from Milwaukee being the Black place for Blacks to actually live at in the United States as a city, for the incarceration rate, for economic disparities, just all of these things that were happening in the Black community. And so I set out to be able to tell the stories behind those statistics. But I also wanted to do it from the youth perspective, because I know that the youth are our future, you know, depending on, you know, it doesn't matter what city they're in, you know, eventually they're going to grow up to be tomorrow's leaders and, you know, potentially also guide the way for what's happening in their community. So with that being said, I set out 4 years ago to actually be able to tell these stories. So back then we didn't have funding yet or anything. It was just the ideal. I was just actually starting my television production company here locally in Milwaukee at the time as well, just getting my name out there. And I was actually able to put, and I hate to say casting call, but for lack of a better word, because I know it's not a narrative or a feature film, but I did allow just to go to nonprofits, but youth-based organizations to say, hey, do you have any youth where we're doing this documentary that you think would be great for us to talk to, that would love to kind of, you know, share their truths and their stories about what it means for them to grow up in the city? And at the time, like I said, it was just concept 4 years ago. But 2 years ago, actually going on three now that we're in 2021, I was able to get our first round of funding to actually start filming. And at that moment, when I got the funds, it was like everything started to come together, kind of what I mentioned, that it was just so purposeful, where when I was actually speaking to a few youth organizations, they happened to have individuals that I felt with Brandon, Marquell, and Tiana that would fit in what I thought would be relevant to, you know, going behind some of the statistics. So prime example, Tiana was a teen mom. Like, she was literally aging out of the group home system. She had a child at the age of 14. And then also Brandon was just literally getting out of, you know, being incarcerated as a teen and being put into a group home. And then Marquell was just dealing with all that he was dealing with internally at home, as well as having mentors actually in his life even before we met. So I felt that the that would be a great fit. And then they were all willing, you know, to be able to share their truths with us at that time. So it just happened exactly how it needed to happen. And I was just so grateful that they allowed me to be able to film with them for 2 years.
And are you yourself a Milwaukee native?
So I am. So I am a Milwaukee native where I grew up in Milwaukee. I am a self-proclaimed floater, for a lack of a better word, because I did leave Milwaukee. I left Milwaukee right out of high school to attend college at Santa Clara University in California. So I was gone for 4 years, moved back with anticipation on working in Chicago, and then kind of went into the news industry here, and then left and moved back out to California to work in the talk show world, and then moved back to Chicago to work in the talk show world and also do some producing work in the industry there. And then that's when about 5 years ago, I decided, you know what, I want to tell stories about what's happening right here in my hometown. And so I became a little bit more stationary, but we do have an office that's also opening in Chicago this spring. So we're excited to kind of create our footprint there as well and be a Midwest-based production company between both cities. But, you know, Milwaukee is always home. I might end up on the moon eventually, but, you know, Milwaukee's home, and I really care about what's happening in the city that I was born and raised in.
Filmmaking is such a powerful tool to share with people what is going on, connecting and creating empathy, because so many people in Milwaukee, their growing up Milwaukee is not what's being shown in your film. And with filmmaking, and especially getting picked up by HBO Max, and congratulations on that, by the way, what kind of work did you do to distribute this film? Because it is such a powerful connector, and ultimately as a filmmaker, that is the goal, to get as many people as you can to see it.
Yeah, and I think, and I've been very fortunate. And when I decided that I wanted to tell the story about what was happening in Milwaukee, I thought nationally. I had no doubt in my mind that what I wanted to tell, I didn't know exactly how it was going to turn out, who was going to be in it, but I knew that it was important to get what was happening in our city on a national level and get behind those stories and to make an impact on a national and international level. So I feel like everything just really came into place, where sometimes it's like, it kind of sounds generic and like a Hollywood ending story, but I have no other way but to put it that it just all continued to unfold in all of the power that it needed to. Over time, as we were filming, the people we met with, like everybody was where they needed to be, including the distribution of it. Because prime example, we did literally start wrapping the film at the end of like 2019 going into 20. And I knew, of course, you know, that I wanted to get that film out in 2020. Like everyone else, we didn't know that the world was going to literally shut down and change as we know it going into 2020. So I believe that I was kind of setting myself up with having a really good rough edit and then being able to aggressively actually get the film out as a director and producer to different networks. I was just aggressively reaching out to networks, you know, letting them know that the film was done, providing them with screeners. So I did actually have the opportunity to have a few different networks actually have interest and offers. And I felt that HBO Max at the time would be a great fit. I think I made the right choice. I feel comfortable with what I did.
In Growing Up Milwaukee, you feature local leaders and also people just being mentors are also just fighting to make Black lives in Milwaukee better. And what struck me the most is that so much of their work is making sure young people simply know their worth, their talents, their potential. You know, it's their sense of hopelessness is kind of really resounding in the film, and the kids are just fighting to not get completely dragged down. So with the title Growing Up Milwaukee, what does it mean to you as the director, and what do you hope it means for the audience after they see this? Because growing up Milwaukee after watching it, you know, it shows a lot of struggle, but also a lot of resilience.
I think it was my initial ideal as well, and especially in the editing process, was to come to an audience where they could say, you know what, all hope isn't lost, because as you said, like there are certain levels of trauma that people weren't, you know, aware that some of the youth are facing, or they actually might have faced that, you know, a portion of that or a little piece of that in their own lives. So it resonated with them, even on a personal level. But yet I want people to walk away that all hope isn't lost. Milwaukee is a lot of things as far as statistics, but we're not hopeless. So I was hoping that people would walk away with that sense, and also that it would potentially be a call of action for people to even say like, hey, what could I do or how can I get involved? Whether that was on a resource level, you know, with reaching out to different youth organizations or even, you know, starting up a youth and grassroots organization on your own. But however that would inspire you to actually want to continue to implement change. But I think that it all should resonate with people that we're all going to go through something. But yet, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, or there's people, as we saw that was in the film, that are out there that are helping create a new narrative and change the narrative that people are currently being, you know, shown about the cities.
Yeah, as you said, there's a lot of indications of the community healers, leaders, but a lot of other people here in Milwaukee have to step up too, and that's everyone from your neighbor to city officials. And one thing that was said in your film by a local expert is that Milwaukee is not willing to look at the realities of our city. And as a native, I agree with that. And you mentioned changing the narrative. So how do we go from the smaller scale to getting city leaders and state leaders and getting changes to policy funding to address the inequities impacting people's lives that keeps them trapped in this narrative, in this cycle?
Sometimes it's not just kind of throwing money at the problems, because once again, the problems won't go. But don't get me wrong, funding and resources definitely count, and they give opportunities for things to grow, but actually coming up with solutions to the problem, and not to say that we're not doing that. But I think, you know, even in legislation, like continuously, we know these problems exist, but how can we be a solution to it? Whether that's funding, whether that's, you know, creating manpower, whether that's creating just different levels of support that would help continue to make things better. And I think we all have to have our hands in it. And it starts from the top. And it's step by step. Things aren't going to change overnight. Just because, you know, I created a film that kind of highlights some of these things. And, you know, fortunately, it's being able to be seen on a national platform doesn't mean that people are going to pick up and, you know, start running and changing things. But I do hope that, you know, there is a sense of urgency to continue working on things that people have already been doing and or starting to implement a new plan and new solutions to some of these same existing problems that we've had for many years.
Well, Growing Up Milwaukee is certainly a powerful film, now available on HBO Max for everyone to see. Tyshawn, I want to thank you so much for not only making it, but of course, taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tyshawn Wardlaw is the director and producer of the documentary Growing Up Milwaukee. Wardlaw spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in February. Next, we'll hear from a Wisconsin blues artist who is a finalist in a national music competition.
You can't separate the black from the blues. It's 100% a cultural story that is in a more, I want to say, digestible form. Like, we're able to listen to it, get something out of it, and then move on about our day. Versus, you know, a poem not everyone might understand, but a pleasant sounding song we all kind of digest on some level.
We'll hear more from Stephen Hull Experience next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. 21-year-old Stephen Hull from Racine picked up the guitar 7 years ago and taught himself how to play the blues. He started the Stephen Hull Experience in 2018 and has been playing gigs in the Milwaukee and Chicago areas ever since. His band was a finalist in the 2021 Interstate Music Awards. They were one of 7 bands chosen as a finalist from around the country, and they walked away with the second-place prize last month. Hull spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver in February about how he got into playing the blues.
So I have always liked, you know, good old school music, but I was fortunate enough to have my father, who liked blues somewhat, and he had found a radio station, I believe it's 1290 out of Milwaukee. I forgot who the radio host used to be, but a program called the Saturday Morning Blues Brunch. And I used to listen to that on the way to the barbershop every weekend.
Hello, Central. Please give me 209.
Nice. And did anything stick out to you, like, on the way to the barbershop? Like, what was that feeling?
Hello. Hello, Central.
It always made me feel like I was listening to something that really just clicked in my head. Like, I've listened to, you know, Motown stuff since I was, you know, really little, but this is what was hitting me in my soul.
I'm just trying to talk to my babe. She done moved way on now.
And that's the thing, you're self-taught. I want to ask you in a little bit if you've had any formal training at this point, but what do you think about the idea, you just kind of touched on it, that the blues is really something you have to feel? You might be able to teach yourself how to play technically, but if you don't have that blues kind of soul, then you can't really do it. Do you feel something like that?
Oh, absolutely. And there's been a lot of controversy over Joe Bonamassa, who's, you know, a front runner of the blues world today, is that he's technically proficient in some of the things I've seen him play, and I know some of the things that other people have seen him play are just phenomenal. He's a great player, but, you know, what he's lacking in the soul area. And so that's what makes it hard for a lot of people to get on board. And the flip side of that is I've seen so many older bluesmen who aren't technically proficient, but they'll play and they'll sing, and it's just like, that's the blues. You know it when you hear it.
Yeah. And can you flesh it out a little bit? What are you feeling when you're playing the blues? Do you just go there into the space of, like, blues soul, or can you articulate a little bit about what it's like for you?
It's an interesting feeling, because when you're in it, you're not really thinking too much. You're listening to either the other people you're playing with, or if you're playing by yourself, you're creating that space where you can either challenge yourself, you know, coming up with different new ideas or something like that, playing something that is a little bit more difficult to play, or you're kind of bouncing ideas off of this music that's been created, and you're just enjoying yourself. Like, you're flowing through your instrument. Like, I've had several moments on stage where it's just like, I'm not playing that guitar, I don't know who is, but it sure sounds good.
Like, you're in the zone.
100%. Like, it has to come from your soul and has to be a 100% vibe.
And I did want to follow up, have you had any formal training at this point? Like, have you followed any music plays along or gone to any teachers or anything like that?
I've had a few people teach me a few things, you know, standard licks, and like, oh, I was like, oh, I've always wanted to learn how to play this song, and they'll go, oh, this is how. But as far as when it comes to technique and such, I haven't really had any formal training. I did take piano lessons when I was a young child, but I quit about a year or two before I started playing guitar.
Ticket agent said my ticket's played out, and he'll see that I don't write and that's the show.
Have you gotten comparisons to other blues artists? Do you have any inspirations?
Well, I have many inspirations. If we're talking old school originals, we're talking Albert King. He's my main influence. We have B.B. King, Lightnin' Hopkins, Elmore James, Robert Johnson. I listen to him, and if we're talking modern day, I'd have to say John Tavius Willis, who is a mentor of mine. He's a brother. He's a brother from another mother. thank God I got to know him, and he's really become a brother to me, especially over this last year. And then we have Marquise Knox. He's out of St. Louis. That brother, hoo wee. He actually was on a tour opening for ZZ Top, I want to say, for their 2019 season.
Nice. Well, that's a long line. And February is Black History Month. How does playing the blues as an art form started by rural Black folk in the Deep South in the late 1800s, early 1900s, how does that connect you to Black history?
So it is, in fact, a story. Whether most people realize it or not, you can't separate the Black from the blues. It's 100% a cultural story that is just in a more, I want to say, digestible form. Like, we're able to listen to it, get something out of it, and then move on about our day. Versus, you know, a poem not everyone might understand, but a pleasant sounding song we all kind of digest on some level.
One more time.
I find it to be really telling, because I'm a bit of a historian a little bit. I'm getting more into blues history as time goes on, but I like being able to listen to a song, listen to how it sounds, like the audio quality, down to the licks that they're using, the chords, the riffs, and then the story that they're telling.
About this woman of mine. Now, she don't ever treat me right, but I got something for her, let me tell you. I'm gonna tell her all about the blues.
Although this is more of a jazz tune that I'm going to use as an example, but Strange Fruit, when it's sung by Billie Holiday, you know, you got to think about what that song really means.
Well, and the first appearance of blues is often dated to the ending of slavery and juke joints that started up. And it's kind of like it's such a beautiful art form, but it's making beauty and soul and joy out of sometimes pain, right?
100%. And that's one thing I find to be beautiful about the Black experience, is that no matter what, there's always going to be that silver lining that someone can make out of it. Resilience is just one of the most astonishing things that I've come to recognize about the Black community.
And do you think that there are lessons in this blues music for the racial justice movement, to end police brutality, to bring more equity to the Black community? Do you think that there's a place for blues in this movement?
Oh, absolutely. Gary Clark Jr. came out with a song not too long ago. I want to say it's called This Land, where it has, you know, I guess by today's standards, some explicit language. But basically, it's him, it's his political stance on a lot of the things going on in this world today. Although some might view the blues as an outdated source of music, anything is bound to change with, you know, the passage of time. So you can have it as traditional or as updated as you want, but it'll still always be the blues, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it can be incorporated into so many different kinds of music and yeah, even on its own, but also as mixings, you know? What impact does playing the blues have on the rest of your life, like your daily life? Like, if you're not playing the blues or listening to the blues, what sort of lessons can you take from the blues into your life?
That everyone, whether we all know it or not, we're all going through something. And although it might suck, you know, for a period of time, it ain't always going to be that bad, hopefully. You know, you got to have that ray of sunshine somewhere waiting for you. I know that I personally cannot stand the day job I work right now. I miss playing gigs all the time. You know, that was the best part of my life so far. But I know that, you know, as much as I'm going through right now, you know, working and whatnot, I'll be able to make it through this and get back to doing what I really love.
You touched upon it a little bit. We're obviously in a pandemic. It's totally clamped down on all life in the arts. There's no gigs, there's no dance performances, no theater. How has that affected your music making?
I personally don't write too much, although I'm getting more and more time to do so now. I was mainly a performer. So that put a damper on like my income. I wasn't able to, you know, express myself musically. I don't meet with my band regularly anymore. So it's like I got put in basically an entire isolation away from an entire way of life.
Yeah. Well, you did have the bright spot, which was the Interstate Music Competition. So, and you, I'm sure you have lots more plans going forward to continue playing the blues. Stephen Hull, thank you so much for coming on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. How y'all doing out there? My name is Stephen Hull. This is a Stephen Hull Experience, and we're going to play a little bit of blues for you.
Stephen Hull is a Racine blues musician. He spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver in February. This is his band, the Stephen Hull Experience, playing the Albert King tune, Gotta Be Some Changes Made. Gotta Be Some Changes Made, performed by the Stephen Hull Experience, wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of the conversations on Lake Effect today, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Join us again tomorrow at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
There's gotta be some changes made.